The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Sadia Hartman has been praised as one of our most brilliant contemporary thinkers in the New York Times Book Review, and a lodestar for a generation of students, and increasingly for politically engaged people outside the Academy and The New Yorker. She joins us this evening with the 25th anniversary edition of her debut book, Scenes of Subjection, Terror, Slavery, and Self-Making in 19th Century America. Her other works include Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, Intimate Histories of Riotous Black Girls, Troublesome Women, and Queer Radicals, and Lose Your Mother, A Journey Along the Atlantic Slave Route. Her many honors include MacArthur, Fulbright, Rockefeller, and Guggenheim Fellowships. She is a university professor at Columbia University. She'll be joined in conversation this evening with Kianga Yamata Taylor, author of Race for Profit: How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Homeownership, which was a semifinalist for the National Book Award and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in History. Her earlier book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, won the Lannan Cultural Freedom Award. Her many honors include Guggenheim and MacArthur Fellowships. She's been named one of the most influential African Americans in the United States by The Root and one of Essence Magazine's top 100 changemakers. She is the Leon Forrest Professor of African American Studies at Northwestern University. Please join me in welcoming our guests to the Free Library.
Hello. Good afternoon. It's the night. Sorry. All right, so we don't have a ton of time, and I have a million questions, so let's get started. How you doing?
I'm good. This is actually my first book event.
Excellent.
For the
Okay, so let's talk about Scenes of Subjection, 25 years of Scenes of Subjection. Where did this book come from? Why did you write this book? How did it come into the world?
Yeah, that's every time someone asks me that, I give a different answer.
Okay.
You know, because like many projects or many of my projects, I kind of, you know, stumble into it. But I thought that there were many questions about Black cultural production that I was trying to answer, and I found myself doing this reading in slavery. And then once I, you know, was doing that reading, I thought, oh my God, people are thinking about slavery with the political concept of hegemony. Mm. And that just seemed so wrong to me. And it just like started me on the path of really thinking about slavery and its constituents and thinking about Black life and Black cultural practice and what was the language available to really rigorously describe it in its complexity. And that was the journey of Scenes.
So I wrote a foreword to this new edition of the book. And one of the things that, you know, I like to do when I'm writing anything is to think about context. So when I wrote the foreword, I was thinking about the context within which the book was published. So there's the topic of slavery itself, and then there is the time in which the book is produced. And so, you know, I was thinking about this period of the late 1990s, and it's a few years after the LA Rebellion, but more, maybe even more importantly, it is, so there's the Los Angeles uprising in 1992. Then there is the passage of the crime bill, which, you know, is seen as the signature moment and the turn, the full tilt into mass incarceration in the United States. But then in the late 1990s, there's almost what I would describe as an absurd discussion about slavery that emerges, where Bill Clinton is going to Africa, and the issue of whether he should apologize about the institution of slavery in the United States then provokes this ill-conceived idea of a quote-unquote conversation about race. That was what the initiative was called. And so one of the questions I had was, any of this, were you thinking about any of these issues in terms of the contemporary conversation about slavery when you decide to take up this issue with the book?
Yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting is that, you know, at that time, and even in the book, even though it's, you know, technically beyond the period, I mean, I think about the racialization of something like the welfare state and how the very inability to conceptualize social needs in this country has everything to do with slavery and the black presence. And, you know, certainly Hannah Arendt addresses this, right? And for her, there's a way that she prefers the American Revolution to the French because the French is too concerned about social needs. And so for me, that is a kind of precedent to really thinking about Clinton's dismantling of the welfare state. Even when we think about the emergence of the welfare state, its benefits largely exclude black people by excluding domestic and agricultural workers. So even when we're thinking about needs, it is totally racialized. I mean, there were a range of critical conversations about, you know, post-coloniality, how is it that we theorize race? And at this moment, you know, Black British Cultural Studies was really, really key. Gramsci was key. People like, you know, Said were key. And everyone thought, what the heck does slavery has to, you know, have to do with that? So there were all of these critical conversations that I imagined myself a part of. But then when I would say, oh, I was working on slavery, people's eyes would, like, glaze over with boredom because there was the notion of, oh, what is that thing? And that's something that, oh, historians, you know, talk about. But it doesn't really have any purchase at all on any of these kind of critical conceptual questions.
So why do you think 25 years later slavery seems to have reemerged as a critical conversation in ways of understanding the conditions of black people? Obviously, there's the 1619 Project is most demonstrative of that, but what has changed?
I mean, I think, and there's also a historian of slavery here, Marisa Fuentes, who also co-wrote the afterword, so I just want to acknowledge Marisa's presence here. I mean, I think that, like that, you know, Clinton conversation on race, that there's a way when we think about the U.S. and its particularity as a racial formation, we have to deal with racial slavery because racial difference is written into the law, right? Into the law of the colonies and of the New Republic through slavery. Obviously, you know, settler colonialism, you know, is also a part of that, but there are these very fundamental characteristics of black life, like precarity, fungibility, disposability, exposure to premature violence, and I think that there's a kind of a structural precedent or the laboratory that marked the Black in those ways has everything to do with slavery and colonialism. So how is it that we would understand racialization? How would we understand anti-Blackness without reference? I mean, I think that there was still a dominant language of prejudice or racism, largely a Marxist discourse on racism was just simply kind of an instrumental understanding of racism being an ideology that divided, you know, the Black and white working class. But that wasn't a structural account that failed to describe its materiality as a motive power. And for me, really thinking about slavery and its particular constituents, I would say it's essential to understanding the character of racialization, or as we would say now, anti-Blackness.
We were talking earlier, and you know, I was saying that one of the things that I have taken away from this book is that slavery is hard. And what I mean by that is I think there's a way that we oversimplify things in this country. And so that slavery becomes a part of the narrative arc of American progress, that it's usually talked about as from slavery to freedom, but that it becomes woven into a story about how great the United States is. And you hear, you know, some particular conservatives who say, well, yes, there was slavery here, but we freed the slaves. And, you know, that says something remarkable about the United States. And so I think the point that I was trying to make was that, you know, one of the things that you talk about, especially in the first part of the book, is the need to get away from the kind of spectacle of slavery, the spectacular violence that is usually highlighted when we talk about slavery. There's the infamous picture of the man who is enslaved, whose back is almost destroyed by the whip. There is the emphasis on violence, the physical violence of slavery. And I wonder if you could talk some about why you think that the focus on the spectacle of violence against enslaved people has worked to distort our understanding of the institution of slavery itself?
I mean, mostly slavery was characterized as a paternal institution, right? As a peculiar institution, but the idea of it being a paternal institution, you know, was a way of thinking about violence as exceptional, as a part of, no, slavery is a relationship of violence, right? It's structured by extreme domination, and I wanted to really underscore that by looking at those scenes where violence was seemingly absent, right? And not looking to the extreme example. And I think I also wanted, again, to give a structural account. In some ways, the way many people were thinking about slavery is that it was totally disaggregated, as if slavery was a kind of, you know, people would think about it from, you know, one household or plantation to another, and it's you know, it's like the way 19th century social reformers thought about the poor, right, in terms of their individual traits and characteristics, as opposed to thinking about, oh, there's capitalism as a structure, and part of the way it operates is it produces immiseration, and then they're the poor. So I wanted to think about the character of the institution not as coincidental, or that these features happen to emerge, but what is it about, how are the things we observe linked to the structural character of slavery? And I think, one, there was the spectacular violence, but I think that there was a you know, in those scenes that I looked at, often they were about pleasure or enjoyment or identification, and saying that, oh, that wasn't because there was some, I pushed against kind of, you know, culturalist arguments. That wasn't because there was a shared culture between the enslaved and the master class, but part of what someone like, you know, Patterson would describe as human parasitism, right? That the relationship of slavery is so predatory that basically every aspect of Black capacity was something to be utilized, could be exchanged, and was at the disposal of the slaveholder. So these, like, you know, figurative capacities, the fungibility, the plasticity of Blackness was produced as a result of the extreme domination of slavery, and that seemed to be a contribution, at least I hoped it would be a contribution towards understanding not only just slavery, but something about racialization and the blackening of the free subject. Who, you know, Du Bois's famous formulation, who is the Black, who's the Negro, the person who's forced to ride in the Jim Crow car. So basically I was trying to think about all of those, you know, forms of inhabitation, use, extraction, that ultimately come to then produce the Black as the outcome of that process, and to understand it as a dynamic social relationship rather than simply an identity.
I think one of the powerful, maybe controversial parts of the book is this question about, it's framed around the issue of agency. And I think the way that this argument, I think, presents itself today is there is now a kind of, I actually wonder what you think about this idea that you can't talk about slaves, that we can only talk about enslaved people, that we shouldn't use the language of slave or slave owners, that those people are enslavers. And I wonder about this in relation to what you argue about the problematic use of the framing of agency when talking about slavery. And basically, part of what the argument is that the whole notion of agency, volition, willfulness, when discussing how enslaved people interact with the system of slavery, kind of imposes the language, the activity of free people onto enslaved people, and kind of undermines the notion of the total domination that you're talking about. And so it moves us away from an understanding of slavery as a mode of domination and into something more reflective of the tensions that might exist in a free society. And so I wonder what you think about what I think are the motivations of people who say we can only talk about enslavement and not people as slaves, is also a part of softening our understanding of what slavery was in order to almost communicate something about the relationship that Black people have in society today, and that really distracts us from the institution of slavery.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I use the word slave and enslaved, and I would talk about slavery because for me that marks, again, a structural position, right? I think people, you know, want to maintain the idea of the kind of the dignity of the enslaved, and that Black life isn't simply totally exhausted by that category of slave. And to me, to say slave isn't to exhaust, you know, those practices. It's just to, you know, to name a structural relationship. And I think it's I think much of, you know, the scholarship that was also very informative to me when we think about kind of like radical historians of the 70s and 80s, what they intended to do was, and particularly arguing against something like the Sambo thesis, right? Like slavery totally destroyed, you know, the dignity of you know, black people and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I think that I would say that there was an irreparable violence of slavery, mm-hmm. as, you know, just as a fact that, and that doesn't, that is not to say that, quote unquote, black people are lesser or that we bear the mark of that irreparable violence. It's just to acknowledge the enormity of the violence that was part of the making of modernity. And it is irreparable. Right. I mean, and we're still living the damage of that making. And I think that, you know, my vision, and this is what often gets me into trouble, is part two of Scenes. Mm-hmm. Because it's really like okay even to think about the extreme violence of slavery, to think about the way in which these notions of the subject or human ultimately act to reproduce, you know, the violence of slavery. I think that the kind of, that the horizon of belief that the negation of slavery doesn't reside in this language of, like, you know, the liberal subject or the citizen, I think that's what people push against. And I think because I was not only reading history, mm-hmm. I was reading Marxist theory, I was reading political theory, I was reading post-colonial theory, so that we know that just in terms of the a Western humanist and liberal project emerges in the context of this, you know, of slavery and coloniality. So it's not like it's not right. marked by that. So there was a way that what we were invited into, right, if we think of like, oh, okay, so there's this movement from slave to citizen subject or slave to human, that very language of human had already been structured by this kind of history of coloniality, domination, settler colonialism. Mm. And so I think it was more about saying like, oh, that ultimately my own, that my conception of what abolition entails and would require is, you know, cannot be met, is, you know, radically insufficiently met by a liberal political imagination. Right. So I think that that was really where, you know, people kind of like often also stop reading, and there's this like, you know, it's like, oh, Saidiya Hartman says emancipation was nothing, and, you know, and there's this sentence, I mean,
travestied freedom.
Right, travestied freedom, you know, there's a sentence in the scenes that actually say, it would be ridiculous to say that nothing has changed, you know, that emancipation changed nothing. That sentence is in the book.
Yes, but, yes, it is.
It's in the book. But really to think about, you know, the way a new racial order of white over black was produced in the aftermath of slavery's legal, you know, abolition was what I was really, really thinking about. And just reading deeply in the kind of congressional debates where they're saying like, okay, the only notion of freedom we want to entertain is a negative one, not under constraint.
Right.
But no endowments, no entitlements, no substantive freedom. And that is just, you know, a part of the historical record.
And so that part two of the book, you know, I think is a very powerful statement about the impairment of American democracy, and really that essentially that because American democracy not only allowed for the existence of slavery, but facilitated its existence, its function, dictated the terms upon which it operated, codified its existence, you know, the Constitution of the United States is a slavery document, it's a document of slavery, that these core aspects of American democracy then immediately raise questions about what black personhood would actually look like, what it would be like in the aftermath of slavery, which is to say that if you have a system that has allowed for the existence of slavery, for the absence of black personhood, then how on Monday, then how on Tuesday do you say that now this system has created black citizenship? How is that contradiction resolved? And your argument is that it's not resolved, and that is why the status of initially the freedman and then the black citizen is complicated from the outset. And so I wonder, for me, then the second part of this book is really a meditation about abolition and why the institutions of the United States, the country that says that it is built on the rule of law, but what is the law, right? The law is an instrument of white supremacy and domination. And this seems to have been interpreted as a particularly dour reading of American society and the possibility of change. And I just wonder how you respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's dour. I mean, dour is like what, like an effective relationship to political structures. I mean, I do think that there's like, you know, a history, and part of the history is that we had this kind of, you know, a discourse of universalism. Yes. That enables on the one hand this incredible hierarchy of the human. So universalism goes hand in hand with racism and right. colonialism. So I think that in thinking about what's abolition might be, it was looking at the limits and all of the kind of legal maneuverings to make notions like equality and liberty to kind of like empty them out, even in the liberal terms, mm-hmm. right? So it's not even like, okay, you know, trying to expand them, but right. just through legal liberalisms to kind of make them have no content. I think that for what I realized in, you know, working through part two, so what would it actually then, what would be required to deliver something like a substantive freedom outside, you know, a view that wasn't naturalizing kind of capitalist relations, right? That wasn't naturalizing or taking for granted the contract as a vehicle for the exercise of freedom, but understanding that to be about coercion, understanding this ordering of human value. So much, there would have to be this radical transformation of values, right? And the system, the material, economic, as well as the symbolic and social production of values to create something like abolition. It's one thing to end a legal relationship of, you know, slavery. It's another thing to kind of disestablish the constituent elements, right? Black precarity, vulnerability to social violence, dishonor, all of those things, and human standing. You know, in Black Reconstruction, Du Bois talks about, you know, every white person had the capacity, essentially exercise the power of police over black folks. So we're talking about an order that is right. fundamentally racialized, that is fundamentally a kind of a white over black order, but that understands itself not explicitly as a racial order, as a racist order, but as a liberal one, right? And there are these kind of variations, or there's, you know, failures, but somehow those failures aren't judgment or don't speak to the terms of the larger structure. In Scenes, I was saying like, no, this has everything to do with the terms of what that larger structure is.
I think, and I said this to you earlier, that this is such a powerful rebuke of liberalism, because I think part of what you're getting at is really a question that has shaped Black political struggle over the course of the 20th century, which is the struggle for inclusion. And I think that you're raising a bigger question, that in the struggle against being excluded, we often turn away from what is it that we're asking to be included into, right? And so there's, I write about this in my book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, this moment between Harry Belafonte and Martin Luther King, where King says, you know, I think that, and this is in 1967, that, you know, our struggle has been righteous and we have done the right thing by opposing Jim Crow. But are we looking to be integrated into a burning house? And by that, he meant that getting the right to vote is important, and then you have these two political parties that you're left to vote for, right? Having a job is important, and then we look at a political economy that ensures that a certain segment of the population will remain in poverty. And so that there is something wrong with the capitalist order itself, and just simply trying to integrate ourselves into that and achieve equal rights into that is part of the problem. And I read part two as you raising this larger question, not just about the condition of anti-blackness or the condition of enslavement and its aftermath, but the society itself, the larger society itself, the market, capitalism, these are key features of the problem of America itself, which is where the abolition, not just the abolition of slavery, but the abolition of the market, the abolition of these deformed social relations is also what must end.
I agree. And that's what was so important for me about reading the testimony of former slaves, because certainly they make, you know, a kind of consistent critique of the limits of, you know, what of possibilities of, you know, of the struggle to just get by, of one's only liberty being, you know, forced to sign a contract. And these notions of there was an imagination of freedom that was much more about collective rights, about forms of sustenance, right? Not being forced into the paradigm of wage labor. And we know just like across the globe, an enormous amount of violence is required to send people to the marketplace to become wage laborers. No one chooses to become a wage laborer, right? You must enclose the commons. You must dispossess people. You must make it illegal to not work, right? If you do not work, right, who are you? You are a vagrant. And that means that you can be arrested and forced to work, so that there's that order of violence that you're right, that is not even then restricted to Black people. And these modalities of coercion, then also, you know, if Black folks are their laboratory, they're also then used to police the white working classes, or the idle classes, right? The idle and dangerous classes. But you hit the core. It's like, if we're then imagining freedom, right? If freedom is the as yet, what are the terms in which we want to imagine it, right?
Right.
And it just felt like, oh, I mean, I had read The Capital. Mm-hmm. I had read Gramsci. So it's not as if, and we just also look at the history of Black struggle and what, you know, and what some of those demands are. And I think that too often our understanding of Black politics has also focused only on the political language of elites, and not on the kind of political struggles of working class people who have also articulated that critique of capitalism, who understand themselves to be exploited, vulnerable, disposable. And I just took very seriously what I was reading in terms of, you know, the WPA narratives about like how anemic the horizon of freedom, of liberal freedom was. And I had a language of political philosophy that was actually in conversation with that testimony.
I've got to open things up to the audience, but I want one quick question.
Yeah, yeah.
25 years later, has anything changed for you? Not just what might I have written differently, because every writer thinks about that 1 week later, but in the larger scope of things, where do you think this book fits in now?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like now there's a moment when it can actually have a readership because, I mean, there's a way that, you know, racial capitalism is a term that many people throw around. You can find a term like anti-blackness in the pages of the New York Times. So I think that there has been a shift and a way in which a certain kind of radical thought has gained a certain ground and that people understand. I mean, you know, one key element of the moment in which I was writing was, you know, critical legal studies.
Right.
So this is, you know, people who are thinking about the limits of right, people like Derek Bell and others in the, you know, critical legal studies movement about like, oh, what rights fail to achieve,
right?
The equality and the transformation that actually couldn't happen through these like legal avenues. So I feel that there's just a much more capacious understanding of what is required, and just the kind of the climate crisis has also helped, you know, I just think people understand the way that we inhabit the earth is utterly unsustainable, and that these histories of slavery and coloniality were part of the shift that enabled this kind of the Anthropocene, right? The plantation as the first, you know, the largest economy of scale that emerges in the modern period. So I think people are making the connections between anti-blackness and capitalist predation, militarism, and environmental degradation. Yeah. The U.S. Army is what, the largest polluter in the globe. So that makes me feel really good, as well as people, you know, exploring a modality of political practices and trying to create institutions, organizations, and ways of living that can help us survive in the meantime.
Yeah.
So that proliferation and opening of radical possibility, I feel happy about that.
That's great. Okay, there are two people on the ends here with microphones. Please wait for them to get to you. Yes.
Hi, how are
you?
I loved the question about enslaved versus slaves, and I'm curious, 25 years later, how you're thinking about language that has emerged in those 25 years, what you embrace, what you reject in conversations, like what is the language that euphemizes the kind of points you're trying to make and dampens the structure of the critique that you have. I'm curious how you thought about that in the revamping of this piece or the updating of this piece, how you're thinking about some of the new language that has emerged in our cultural, like in the cultural space.
That's a good, you know, because like slave, enslaved, black, capital B or, you know, small b. And I think that, you know, I'm always interested in the minor and the labor of like the negative. And so I use small b. And it's not because, you know, I'm really talking about like a kind of a critical relationship to the norm. And what I feel is this kind of like radical negative capacity of blackness. And so for me, that underscores it. It's not that like, you know, oh, black people aren't subjects. It's not like, oh, if I'm in a collection and capital B is the norm that I oppose it. But those are the kind of stakes. I mean, I think that part of the project of like liberal inclusion is that we're always being assimilated into the category of, you know, the subject, right? And I just feel that's a kind of distraction rather than that enabling something. I tried in doing the revisions to honor the position that I the positions that I staked out in scenes. So it wasn't like a major, like, oh, what? There are all these newer concepts that are afloat now. Let me import them. I wanted to actually just revise in lesser ways. But there was one thing that was actually really interesting, and I feel like I should I give it away or not? But like one point that I did revise is that, you know, I think in the introduction, I was describing the character of my historical labor, and I said, it's not, I want to find it exactly. I want to find it exactly, because I think that there's certain things that changed and evolved. So if there was something, it was more like, oh, is there something that I can't, that I don't believe in anymore? Right? And it was just basically, it was about the nature of the kind of radical counter-historical project that I feel like I'm a part of. In the earlier scenes, I said, well, my labor isn't, it's not really that different from, and now I don't believe that. It's very different from that. So that was like a small revision, but that was more about me reflecting on the nature of my practice and my deepened understanding that an infidelity to certain kinds of disciplinary norms is absolutely essential in the production of, you know, imaginative and radical thought. So that was a moment that changed. I didn't incorporate all of these really kind of rich discussions of anti-blackness and its variants. And I used that word very sparingly, maybe 3 or 4 times in the text, because largely I was using the language of racialization and racial formation. So I didn't want to update it in a way that eliminated the mark of time on it. Right. But you know, one thing we didn't mention, practice. But so are there any, though, questions, comments, reflections?
I am interested in the methodology of waywardness and finding beauty in a new way of being free in this in-between space where there is not really an answer, no really a destination, but just your body, yourself, and just like nature is, the body is, but what kind of identity can you find and how, what role does beauty play here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's something that's there's a strong resonance between scenes and wayward lives. I mean, in Wayward Lives, I talk about, you know, thinking about the chorus as, you know, as dancing inside the enclosure, right? And certainly in scenes, practice is really central, right? Practice is really critical, and I, with some of the notations that are in the book, and I think that one of the revisions, which actually goes to your question, is I do feel like that I tried to account for that conceptual amplification through the critical notations in the book. But I think that in attending to practice, I mean, that's the way, that's where I'm talking about what does it mean to not only to act in a way that's antagonistic to the order, but any way of inhabiting the body that would imagine it as, you know, not property at all is fundamentally antagonistic to this, you know, order which, you know, can only understand the black body as, you know, as property, as material, as being generative of value. And I think that maybe possibility is more the word in scenes than quote-unquote beauty, but it is definitely, yeah, thinking about like, oh, what kind of redress is even possible to conceive inside the context of the plantation order or social death, right? And I think that, you know, it's not that there's the kind of the enormity of the apparatus of the structure that is against the enslaved. And that's not simply, you know, the individual slave owner. That's the U.S. state. as a project, right, that supporting slavery as an institution, right, that's making, and then after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act, where the whole country is signing on board to the slaveholding project. So there are all of these fugitive practices, there are all of these, you know, Black cultural and imaginative and spiritual practices that are utterly antagonistic to the order and thinking beyond it and exceeding it, but it's, you know, it's a scalar distinction between power, between...
And you distinguish between agency and practice?
I do, because agency is, it's very much, you know, connected, I think, with certain notions of the individual, of the will, a certain kind of like endowment of the subject, whereas practice, I'm thinking about in terms of the non-autonomy of the field of action. Right. So what do you make happen, or how do you do when there's no space or territory that's, you know, your own, but that you're creating and transforming relations in the moment. So another small elaboration along those lines was thinking about something like redress, and now it's like redress, and I have this double colon that says, you know, how the broken body moves. So what does it mean to think fundamentally about something that's broken, something that's an implement, but something that also moves, something that's arrested, but something that moves. So that's how I would answer a question.
Thank you for writing these books. And to me, I have read Venus in Two Acts and Wayward Lives, and now I'm going to read this. And to me, as someone who's trained as a historian, these books are really liberating experiences of reading. Now, my question is, when I was reading these books, and also when I was reading your book, Professor Fuentes, I felt that they're dispossessed lives. I felt that there are moments, actually, where we transcend history writing, literary writing, and almost get into some sort of spiritual writing, right, where we are spiritually able to understand the speech of these Black bodies who were killed and were subjected to violence and so on and so forth. And I was wondering if this was really a spiritual experience for you as much as it was a spiritual experience for me as a reader of your books, and how do you deal with those spiritual experiences other than just writing them down, you know? Like, how do you write them down, you know? Because to me, it's incredibly difficult to have these sort of, like, spiritual experiences and at the same time to be able to, like, grammatically capture them in a language, right? Mm. So I'm kind of interested here in this kind of, this like deep, intimate struggle of writing these experiences down after going through these like archives in a very, very intimate way.
Yeah, that's an important question. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, I think maybe I would call it a kind of communion or relation. And really, what does it mean to be when I'm at my desk, but I'm in a room with others, right? Mm. And how do I find my way to a figure like Suki, who emerges in the testimony of another formerly enslaved person, right? And then that's about, I don't think that there's really, in terms of like the practice of writing, that great a difference between how a novelist or a playwright or a historian builds character. And partly that's about like, oh, you're listening to language, right? How does someone speak? What are they saying? What are they withholding? To really to think about embodiments, you know, and something like Lose Your Mother with, you know, the young woman who's murdered on the slave ship, really just thinking about physically, just simply not what's happening to her, but what's happening when you're inhabiting that body, when your body is suspended or turned upside down You know, one of the things I really appreciate about Dispossessed Lives, Marisa Fuentes' book, is that often, you know, she's working with testimony from, you know, those kind of British parliamentary debates. But what does it mean to kind of just like change perspective from her to she, right? And what that she opens up, I mean, it's a radical shift in your relationship to the person and the experience that's being described. Nothing, you know, none of the facts are made up, but how you're looking at the scene, mm-hmm. and where you're standing, how you're watching, how you're witnessing, that radically changes. And I think that's both about an ethical or spiritual relation. It's about an imaginative relationship, and it's about, you know, at the end of the introduction of Scenes, I have, you know, that famous Walter Benjamin quote. But I really believe that, right? Like, there's this way about what does it mean, what's required to attend to the lives of the dead, and feeling myself to be coeval with the dead, right? And the kind of the ethical responsibilities that are entailed in attending to other lives. So,
thanks so much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.